All right, Blair, I'm having a little technical problem. It makes me very suspicious.
Okay.
You know, my
Yeah,
paranoid
no.
mind, I don't know, but here we are.
Here
So
we're back.
please continue. We're talking about what happened with Waco.
Right. So you, I think to see the truth get shredded in Congress is one, you know, aside from the deaths of those poor people, like a total of 82 people died in that fiasco. Seeing the truth just get shredded between the Democrats and the Republicans, it really was a bipartisan effort to mincemeat of the truth in order for each side to make some type of political gain. But another element of the Waco disaster was the accusations of David Koresh being a child molester. And we
Right.
see, watch out when some they start accusing people of these things. Sometimes these are ruses. Stockpiling weapons and child molestation were the two weapons used against Koresh. They interview, and this chapter on Waco, there's one documentary called The Waco, The Rules of Engagement. And much like in the following chapter on 9/11, you can watch one documentary and that will clear up the kind of the baloney that we've been told. So Waco Rules of Engagement, I think, came out in 1997, where they show the FLIR overhead and they interview the local sheriff, for whom, well, for one thing, what jurisdiction does the ATF have over child molestation? Well, it doesn't. There was no legal reason for the ATF to be investigating that. That would have
Right.
been a local matter. And they interview the local sheriff in that documentary. And he says, you know, the law in Texas is that when there's parental consent, because David probably was having sex with a girl as young as 14 years old, but her parents consented to it. And she clearly had consented to it too. So the idea that he was somehow abusing children or molesting children was overblown and distorted in order to kind of weaponize that charge against him to go after him.
Right, and by the way, even if he was, there's a proper process, a due process that could have been conducted to determine, not starting to firebomb a house where all the children are murdered.
Yes, you kill a bunch of children to get to David because you think he's abusing children. It's preposterous.
Of course, and
So
even.
there's any number of facts that they bring up in this documentary, Waco, The Rules of Engagement. It is still out there. I bet you Rumble carries it in their lineup. But
Yeah.
one thing they bring up, they talk to the sheriff on that, and they say, no, whenever anybody, and it was not frequently, but there were those who were suspicious of what David was up to. There's no doubt he had it in his mind. He would hold up the Bible and see himself prophesied in the Bible. And he was using the religious naivety of his followers, really, in order to get access to women. His belief was that he was going to father 24 children that would inaugurate the last days and the millennium and this kind of stuff. So there's no doubt David is kind of as a charismatic fella, using religion to get his way and to persuade his people. But just the same, the sheriff says that anytime there was an allegation brought against him, we would go out to investigate, and there was never any evidence of child molesting.
Right. And it doesn't sound like, even though we may not like those kinds of activities immorally, which we don't, there wasn't anything illegal there. I mean, we're talking about consensual adults under the laws of Texas. And, you know, I mean, it's not a cause for like blowing up a house. And I think in the aftermath of that terrible thing, and we kept seeing the video of the house being firebombed, I think the people felt uneasy about that. You know, this was a private home of a citizen, and it was blown up. It was literally bombed like you'd bomb in a war. And you know, it came right after this very strange figure became the attorney general, that being Janet Reno, who presided over it and who was essentially installed and then immediately authorized this whole operation.
Yeah, she's interviewed in that documentary, and it's quite clear she has no idea what's going on. And she's really, I often say when I show that to my students, that documentary, see there, and I have a questionnaire for them to fill out for extra credit. And she's quite clearly a basket case. She's just completely out of touch with what's going on.
Right.
But fine on that situation, Charles, I believe that happened about a year or so after the Ruby Ridge incident, where
Indeed.
the ATF again had been left with egg on their face. They had bungled a raid. They had killed a woman and her baby, and
Yeah.
it's as though they were trying to resurrect their reputation. You know, with these agencies, there's budgets involved, appropriations, And, you know, the other agencies, the FBI and any other law enforcement agencies are kind of mocking the ATF. And they felt, the ATF felt that if they could revive and resurrect or refurbish their reputation somewhat, that that would be, the Branch Davidians would be a way to do that. And they also showed that video how the night before, one of the agents calls the local media and says something's going to be going down. So that's called foreknowledge, going down tomorrow in Waco.
Right.
Clearly planning this thing. And that was after 51 days of just terrible, terrible behavior on the part of the ATF.
Oh, yeah. They were sieging the place and starving them out. Yes. And it was really despicable. Now, you know, this, I think it's also fair to note that the Waco event occurred, I believe, 1 year before the Oklahoma City bombing of the Mara right. building. Do you get into that?
No, I don't get into that, but I understand that there is I think it was like who's the Timothy McVeigh there, who was either the fall guy or whatever his role
whatever
was.
Whatever he was, yeah.
Yeah, whatever his role was in that. Well, there's a documentary on that. I think Alex Jones's outfit did a documentary on that. And you know, yes. much 9/11, they found cutter charges. I mean, beams had been cut in that building. Now, we were told McVeigh just drove a truck full of fertilizer and blew it up. That does not explain the cutting of beams.
Yeah, the way that building collapsed. But anyways, let's go on to your speculation on 9/11, September the 11th of 2001, and the collapse of the World Trade Center in New York and the bombing of the Pentagon.
Yeah, that was clearly an inside job, as you would say, in order to, they got 20 years of war out of that, right? We invaded Afghanistan and we just withdrew there. What was in 2021? We withdrew there from Afghanistan. So that was a war provocation early on.
Well, what about the 19 hijackers? Who were they?
Yeah, I mean, to the degree that they were there, they would have been patsies. I believe they were in the employ, many of them, especially the ringleaders, the pilots on each of the four planes. They had military associations. They were probably working for the drills, right? The Webster Tarpey's done some good work on this, on the military drills that were taking place in and around 9/11.
Well, I know that they were students at an aviation school,
right,
but their passports had expired and they were allowed to stay in the country thanks to the Frank Amendment, which was passed to basically hamstring the government from deporting people unless they had absolute proven terrorist associations. So they were in the country, I think all of them, if not most of them, they were here technically illegally. But what about Bin Laden?
Yeah, what about Bin Laden?
Wasn't he the mastermind pulling the strings on them?
I wouldn't think so. No, he was. What was he, in a cave in Afghanistan? I mean, clearly he was the patsy. He was the face of this, so he existed and everything. I mean,
well, he took credit for. I mean, a couple of years before it, he was interviewed by this reporter. I think his name was Miller from CBS, and he was basically saying that this is coming down the pike and that we're going to do this. And I think that there's connections between Al-Qaeda and the bombing of the U.S. embassies at Dar es Salaam and Nairobi. You know, so I don't think that they're, I think they must have had at least some hand in this.
There was a British politician who said that the base, you know, Al-Qaeda means the base, right? That it was actually a database of any number of these Mujahideen characters that were under the employ of our secrets, you know, whether it was us using the CIA over in Afghanistan and using the SIS, right, the Pakistani intelligence services. There's a whole web of connections of these.
You know, in this area, you are onto something only because, and I'm talking here about conventional knowledge, stuff that's been vetted by the mainstream Mockingbird media. I'm not making this up, but This has to do with the operation under the Reagan administration to destabilize the Soviet Union by aiding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Let's not forget, in 1990, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and deposed the king and replaced it with a Soviet puppet government. And Then there was a lot of unrest. You had the Northern Alliance, which was fighting against them. And the United States went in big time in terms of helping the dissidents against the Soviet regime, because they knew that they could bleed the Soviets, and they did, to their credit. The Soviet Union eventually, this is one of the major factors that led to their collapse. However, the downside to it was that they helped arm and train Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as our allies. And then they, at least by conventional wisdom, they then turned on us after they were victorious in Afghanistan. But what you're suggesting is that maybe at least an element of them might have continued under the employ of the United States. And I don't think there's any denying that they were in the 1980s during the war against the Soviets.
Yeah, and one thing is, how did these pilots get these planes into their targets? Charles, you don't just get in behind the cockpit of a Boeing 767 and just fly by eyesight and steer it to the towers.
Right.
Understanding, if you'll just look at the kind of connect the dots and look at the timing, the whole onset of drone technology really began in Afghanistan when we started using the drones. And I guess it was in 1999, what was the name of that technology, where we flew pilotless a commercial jet across the Atlantic. So it's my understanding that very likely there were homing beacons in the towers, and those planes were directed. Once the hijackers broke into the cockpit, and remember, there was a, who's that actor there? He went on Fox and he was saying about a year, August before September 11th, he saw some of those characters on the planes, same flight, flight 11. It was from Boston to LA, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But reported it to the FBI.
Right. And those guys were able to just get on those planes here in Boston, just using, and all they had on them was paper cutters. And it's just, there is something about it that seems awfully sanitized. And also the idea that these planes could somehow hit those buildings, and that, which I think they did, but that would lead to a complete collapse of those buildings. Of course, there's Building 7, which was detonated, and nobody ever talks about that. That had nothing to do with the collapse. So, there are incomplete elements of what happened there. Whatever happened, I would tend to think that there was involvement by radical Islamic forces, only because after the 9/11 attack, there was various radical Islamic attacks around the world. You had them in Bali, in Indonesia, and in Madrid, there was a major attack, and in London subway, there was a major attack, and elsewhere around the world. So I don't think that can be something that's completely orchestrated. That's more organic.
The fact that some of those characters exist, that there would be Muslims in the Middle East or in other parts of the Islamic world that have a grievance against the United States for something that we've done, they provide the fact that they are real, they provide the cover story then for our guys to go ahead and typical false flag, right? That's the motive of a false flag. You blame an external enemy for this event when in fact you've done that event. But the fact that enemy is out there is real. There are Muslims in the Middle East. Have we not? All you have to do is go back, look at the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and understand that there are any number of Muslims who don't side with Israel, and they side with the Palestinians. And who is the chief sponsor of Israel? Well, the United States, and they act that out. So you're absolutely right. There are Islamic actors out there who don't like the United States and have a grievance against us.
Well, it's more than just the United States. I mean, I tend to believe Huntington's thesis of Islam's bloody borders. If you look at any country where Islam is bordering non-Islamic countries, you have war, and you have war within many countries. And again, I'm not here to condemn all Muslims, the vast majority of whom are not involved in this. It's a very small sect that I think views very radicalized aspects of their doctrine And I think that they've been radicalized, frankly, by maybe the United States, but more likely by the Soviet Union, which set up El Fatah and trained Arafat and his people in Russia to have a cell and to attack not just Israel, but the West. So it's a very complicated story. But what I think we can say is that in the aftermath of the terrible events of that day, and the idea that Americans or any of the deep state would be involved in such a heinous attack that resulted in the deaths of 3,000 innocent people, I mean, it's almost impossible to get your mind around that. I don't know if I really can get my mind around that. I'm not endorsing it. But we do know that in the aftermath, they use that as a pretext to pass the USA Patriot Act and to criminalize and supersede and compromise the United States Constitution in many ways. So
these are very painful realities of the deep state, as you put it. And I'm afraid there's just no getting around the fact I put it as simplistically as this. You can't use two planes and take three buildings straight down. It's just a physical impossibility. So
right. It doesn't seem plausible to me either. I mean, I generally have avoided getting into this, but here we are. And also the Pentagon, that's a strange one, because I think at the same time, the Pentagon was under criticism for having lost, what was it, like $500 billion or something like that. And the part of the Pentagon that was bombed was the part that kept all those records. So, you know, there are some very strange things going on there.
3,000 architects and engineers have been willing to stick their necks out. Although, you know, how much you want to say is another matter. Even me, I'm a professor at a university. I don't go there. I don't go to these places with publicly.
Right. You have to be careful. I mean, I generally have avoided the subject because it's a little bit too much on my plate, you know, I'm in trouble enough, you know, getting banned on YouTube. But the point is that, yes, I think there are some things that we can examine that are on the record that occurred in the aftermath. The USA Patriot Act, which is 1,000 pages, suddenly appeared out of nowhere as if it was just written. That goes back to the anti-terrorism legislation that was proposed after the Oklahoma City bombing, and that was rejected by Congress at the time, and that was championed by a young representative who had just been elected in the House by the name of Charles Schumer. Also right here in Massachusetts, Congressman Barney Frank championed that legislation. I interviewed him on my show at the time. And what that did was it was under the guise of stopping, quote, domestic terrorists, homegrown American so-called terrorists, who could be held against their will, not face a trial, put in solitary confinement, not have a lawyer, not have the evidence read against them, you know, and all these other laws that are typical of a radical communist or Nazi country and are completely unconstitutional, which is why it was rejected. I wonder if that didn't resurface in the USA Patriot Act, because that seems to be what's happened. And what's going on right now with people who were on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, because they are, quote unquote, called insurrectionists, they're being held, I mean, 2 years later against their will. I mean, against their will for sure, but without due process, without consulting a lawyer. In some cases, they're being tortured. And there's no trial and there's no formal charges. So I wonder if that anti-terrorism legislation is what's enabling the government to do this kind of thing.
It could very well be. I mean, there's the whole legal side of it, as you say. The geopolitical implications of these events are range far and wide. I would ask all too, after 9/11, remember the anthrax attacks?
Right.
Within a couple of weeks after 9/11.
Was it Tom Brokaw and a few people that were getting these anthrax envelopes?
There we go. And that anthrax, that had a fingerprint. I mean, that's something you can trace to its roots, and it came from Fort Detrick military lab. Mm-hmm. And remember, at first they fingered a guy named Steve Hatfield. He denied it. He had anything to do with it. He worked in that lab. And then 8 years later, after enough time goes by that the public has forgotten about it, They give him $8 million. And then they finger another guy, Bruce Ivins, and within a week, he's dead of a suicide, which his family said, and he was not suicidal. So either he was suicided or he saw in the cars they were going to come after him.
Right. And Fort Detrick, by the way, was where they were doing gain of function research on viruses. And I think that even Obama banned that along with the bipartisan Congress in 2014, because it was seen as just too dangerous. And there was apparently real threat that something could escape from the lab at Fort Detrick, which is in Maryland. And so what happened is you had people like Anthony Fauci, apparently, and this is according to congressional questioning, and Collins from the NIH and several other doctors export this kind of research to the Wuhan lab in China, which is, of course, the enemy of the United States. I mean, this is a communist country. And to me, that's...
But is it really? See, I believe the way these shadow elements work. Our military was in that lab in Wuhan. The Chinese military were in that lab. I think this narrative of cowboys and Indians, good guys and bad guys, is meant for us. They're commies or they're the enemy. And really, our bad guys are working in hand in glove with these other characters. So, right, talking about the Wuhan situation and this, what we've been through the last couple of years, 3 years now. I mean, I have a very difficult time seeing that as anything other than another inside job. They release this thing. And one thing that makes me convinced of that is why the suppression of alternative therapies.
Right. I mean, you know, no, look, I tend to agree with that. I mean, it's, I don't know if they all are completely in collusion with each other, because I think there's rivalries and there's wars within this international structure. That's actually what I think the world wars were about in a way, but okay. We don't know that. But the point is that we do know is that the virus, however it came about, and I think that most doctors now admit, even the New York Times admits, that it was probably out of that lab in Wuhan. The way it was handled was very strange. There were so many lies around it. I mean, this was the exaggeration of the number of cases, the fear-mongering, the banning of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and vitamin D3 and zinc.
It was all done to get us in line for the vaccine.
Oh, yeah. No, I believe that. And I think that it also was done to take Trump out, because Trump is one of those figures, like JFK was, who didn't play ball with this establishment, who was, he actually thought that he was elected to be the president, not these usual figurehead types who were just sort of cutouts for other powers. And I think they determined that they would try to use this virus, however it happened, to take him out. In fact, this has been admitted by Deborah Burke. She's that weird doctor with all the scarves in her book, where she says they slow walked data and they tried to drag their feet so they could continue to prolong the lockdowns as a way to hurt business and to hurt Trump. Can you imagine how despicable that is?
I mean, it was a transfer of wealth. I always say they did that for three reasons. There were whatever virological goals they had in mind, get that vaccine into us. There was obviously the geopolitical implications, the bullying of other countries and getting them to coordinate their laws with ours. I watched that with Kenya, the country where I go do some research, and Kenya just took its marching orders from the United States. And I think if we think in spheres in the geopolitics globally in terms of spheres of influence, the countries under the domain of Russia or China or us, they are bullied into what it is we want. And then there was the third element is the transfer of wealth. The number of wealth that went up the chain and the small businesses that were crushed. And yes, whatever political gain domestically and internationally they can get from it. Sure, if that was to damage Trump, why not? If it was to, again, push some other political agenda internationally, well, of course. So, yeah, it's very hard to see these as honest, organic, the case of the plague now or the pandemic, to see it as an organic reality coming from a wet market because it was the handling of it that for me demonstrates.
Oh, I don't trust anything to do with with COVID. I mean, it needs to be investigated. And now that it's the reason, I think the only reason why they were foiled in their attempt to create an electronic passport that would have been the end of freedom for all people of the world, and which was talked about by Klaus Schwab in his book, The Great Reset, The COVID Virus, I mean, which was released around the time this whole thing started. The only thing that stopped them was the great Canadian truckers.
There we go. I was just thinking about those guys.
Oh, yeah. Thank God for Canada. They stood up and they shut down the highways, and they showed that truckers run the world. I mean, if you mess with truckers, you know, they could bring an economy to a halt, and that was spreading. It was going to Australia, New Zealand, France, even Israel. There was already rumbles, and it was basically to stand up against this electronic passport in order to do business. And you look at the way they were attacked and their bank accounts shut down, and they were called Nazis, putting aside the fact that the majority of these truckers are men of color. I mean, it's ridiculous. But yet they did stop it, at least temporarily. I mean, they'll probably try it again in another guise. They don't give up. But, you know, you had these things rescinded after that because they needed to get the trucks back on the road.
And look at our media, how they hardly talked about it while it was happening. It was just wicked how our media heard that story. They don't want the American people to know that if we band together and we stand up, we can effect a change. I'm very proud of the people of China right now. Look at what they did in their country. They just had enough of their totalitarian Xi, and the people went out in mass. Didn't somebody throw themselves off of a balcony, for crying out loud?
Yeah, well, they had a situation where their lockdowns were so extreme that they welded shut this building, and I think 10 people burned to death, and that triggered massive unrest throughout China. And but yet, you know, it seems like they have, and they're talking about this right now at Davos with the World Economic Forum. They are really trying to consolidate control through through what we're doing right now, the electronic, you know, big tech media. That's why I'm on Rumble, not YouTube. And so far, Rumble's been good, you know, knock on wood. But the thing is that they want to control the means of communication, as Karl Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto, and is the definition of socialism. And they want to do it through this massive censorship program, which eventually is going to include digitized currency, which will mean that every transaction you engage in will go onto a computer screen and they can shut it off. You can be starved. Now they're talking about, in fact, I think that they quietly signed a law saying that every American car by the year 2030 is going to have a kill switch. Wow. You know, they can shut it off if they don't like you. So I'm just saying this control mechanism is goose-stepping forward, and it's been in every generation going all the way back as a believer. I think it goes back to Adam and Eve. But the point is that in this day and age, they have tools at their disposal that are much more deadly and much more dangerous than ever before, in the form of artificial intelligence, transhumanism, all of it.
And this attempt to control the world's population, I find it no coincidence that, you know, the Georgia Guidestones, right?
It was blown up. What happened with them?
They were demolished. I think the elites got wind that, hey, we can't have this out here. We're being a little too forthright with what our plans are. And the pandemic kind of was, if you look at the pandemic and if you're suspicious about that and you look at the Georgia Guidestones, you can say, well, gee, can't you see a connection here?
Oh, yeah. So, well, that basically called for the world population to be set at a certain number.
500 million max.
Right. And, you know, I do think that population control has always been part of the agenda going back to Darwin. You know, this idea that we evolve a superior species of people, and that to winnow away the weaker members. You know, look, it does seem obvious to me that that has a hand in all of the way they're manipulating events, which are real, but they're being manipulated in a way that benefits them. So, Blair, what tell me about another chapter of your excellent book.
Okay, going back then, chapter 5 is about the UFOs and how Roswell, 1947, the crash in Roswell, how that was largely done to, and then the fomenting in culture, right, popular culture of aliens and this kind of thing, that was done to basically cover up the Operation Paperclip and the technology we had imported after the war, which ultimately gave rise to our B-2 bomber or the B-57, you know, that winged thing there. That took a whole generation to develop that technology.
Mm-hmm.
The delusion of aliens and for my field in religious studies, there are what are called the UFO religions, your Heaven's Gate and Raelians, and there's a couple of others. So they've been largely used to cover up that element. And of course, our military had something to gain by that, right? People were seeing these experimental craft being flown in the skies of the United States. This would have been over the 50s and 60s. And ultimately, they unveiled the B-2 bomber in the 1988, I think it came out, 87. So that's the delusion in that case. Chapter 4 centers more on Israel, the idea of the biblical return of the Jewish people to their home state, that's been used as a narrative to deny Palestinians their rights and to support, because Israel is our ally. So in the delusion part, and that is that the Bible has been used against, largely in this case now, right-wing Christians to unwavering support for Israel.
Okay. I mean, you and I don't agree on that one, but, you know.
Well, I mean,
I consider myself, I'm not a Zionist, because if I was, I'd live in Israel, but
sure.
I'm very pro-Zionist. I mean, I think that Israel as a Jewish state is biblical, and sure. That the creation of Israel and the sovereignty of Israel is miraculous, and it's also an example of standing up against this world order, which I think was behind the Nazi Holocaust. And, you know, it's for sovereignty. And I think Israel reaches a branch of peace and aid to all Arab states to join them. And it's an example of a rise of national sovereignty that I think the establishment despises and they want to snuff out. But you and I don't agree. Anyway,
well, I wouldn't even disagree with those major points. I mean, yeah. it's the political traction that can be gained from these stories that I'm highlighting. So.
And I feel bad for the Palestinian people. I mean, I've worked in Israel in a spice factory for a while, and I got to know Palestinians. And generally speaking, they admire Israel and like Israel, but they want to have a sovereign Palestinian state in Gaza and in the West Bank, which I agreed with. But the problem is that their leadership is not interested in their welfare. They're interested in annihilating Israel and using those areas as a launching pad to destroy Israel. And as long as they do that, there's not going to be the kind of peace that should exist there.
Yep, anyway. Fair enough.
Yep.
Chapter 3 has to do with the Cold War rhetoric of atheism, how atheism was used it was linked to communism. You know, so if you think during the 1950s, when the Red Scare was underway, there were any number of people who were
godless communism, right?
Yeah, there you go, that kind of thing.
Well, so, they are godless. I mean, communism is atheist.
Sure, but there are any number of atheists who are not communists. So
and there are number of, I think that the entire elite group that we're talking about is generally speaking atheistic. I mean, if they're not outright atheists, then they're into some weird occultic stuff that, you know, like the theosophy of the UN. And this idea, you know, of perfectibility of man. I mean, the theosophy seems to combine Darwinian science, so-called, with weird, you know, the ideas of Atlantis and the creation of this earthly utopia. That seems to be the religion of the UN. It's not Judeo-Christian faith.
Right. And again, what I'm highlighting in this book is the political gain that is sought by making these arguments. So to link atheism with communism, whatever a personal actor's view might have been, if he was not a Christian and he was an atheist, he had to be careful about how he spoke about it, lest he be tagged as a communist as well. And that was just for sure really political theater.
Oh yeah. Well, there's no question it went overboard in terms of, you know, creating an enemy that transcended just the actual enemy, which was, I think, the Soviets. after World War II, but eventually it became your regular high school teacher who might have said something that seemed a little pink.
There we go. That so, maybe wanted evolution or teaching in the schools or wanted right. to Darwinism, which is the subject of chapter two, how which is called evolution versus creationism. How that whole Scopes monkey trial, which we're taught in our textbooks, is a battle between science and religion, was really something of a cover up for eugenics, the eugenics
program
that were underway at the turn of the century. Life was very cruel at the turn of the century, and I think the Nazis even looked to the Americans.
They did. And there's a lot of information about that. I mean, none other than Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a great liberal justice, he authored the bill Buck versus Bell, which basically allowed the government of Maryland to sterilize a young woman because she was too promiscuous under the ideas that she was. He said, we don't need any more idiots, he said, in the language of that bill. So yeah, eugenics was all the rage.
If you and I were brothers and we had a brother who stole a car, they would come and sterilize all of us in the belief that criminality and in the family.
So that's again, right.
Mm-hmm. It's the degree to which these things can be taken way out of proportion. And
again, I don't think that's ever gone away. I mean, obviously after World War II, it had a bad name and a bad stench because of, eliminating races and inferior races and all that. But I think that it's remorphed itself. I think it's taking on a different, more subtle guise. This idea that man is nothing more than an intelligent animal, that we're nothing more than, there's no soul, there's no God, there's no greater spiritual side to us. It's all just genetic. It's all creating and manufacturing. And I think we see that now with the transhumanism of people like Noah Harari in Israel and his Homo Deus, and with people like Ray Kurzweil here at MIT, who are talking about creating a new species of man that's going to combine living people with computer components. And that it sounds an awful lot like the Ubermensch. It's like a perfected person who has cosmic consciousness and who's going to live to be 200 years old and who's going to be beautiful and strong. It sounds to me a little bit like that.
It's an updating, a techno-updating idea going back to Arianism, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed, which, by the way, was a theory that was originally concocted by the founders of theosophy, Helena Blavatsky, in her book Isis Unveiled, where she actually invented and coined the word Aryan and developed this whole idea of this super race, that came about through breeding in that case. And it was a logical, actually, it is a logical manifestation of Darwinism, because if you believe that man is evolving into a superior species, or if all species are, then yeah, you would believe that eventually a superior species is going to pop out of the human species.
Well, what do you make of this combining then for medical purposes, people who've had strokes or people who suffer from various diseases, debilitating muscular diseases, think of our troops coming back and with severe injuries and putting the electrodes into the brain in order to regain some function. When I hear transhumanism, I typically hear it from the negative side, that there's this synthesis of computer technology and organic life, but there can be a positive.
Indeed. You're absolutely right. There are positive aspects to it that can improve and prolong life. No question about it. Just like anything else, there are positive aspects of nuclear developments too. I mean, these things can be used for good. The problem is that they are taken over by people who don't have the good intentions and who use them for part of their evil design. I mean, that's really the issue. The technology itself is inanimate and it can be, it's medicine. It could be used to help people, no question. So anyways, Blair, tell my listeners and viewers where they can get your book and website or any information you'd like to share.
I do have a Wix website where I go through, have some documentaries and a bibliography, and that would be at bgadsby.wixsite.com/blog. The book can be ordered, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, Charles, at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or from the publisher Trine Day. That's typically the preferred
Indeed.
Source.
Yep.
But yeah, and that's basically it. I'm mostly an academic. I bury my head in my studies. And as I said, I just got back from Africa. The big talk in Africa among my friends was Bill Gates had been there in the last couple of months pushing the GMO. And that's got them concerned because, you know, fresh produce and growing your own papayas and mangoes and all kinds of things are just everywhere on the coast of Kenya is where I go. And mm-hmm. now trying to shift it over to this GMO stuff, which ultimately, the way I understand it, leads with sterilized seeds. So once they can control the access to seeds and, you know, replenishing your organic food supply or your food supply naturally, then they've got control of the food supply. And that has
very bad. And I think there's a lot of resistance to that in several countries, including Italy. They ban American GMO products. And I think that the Pacific Rim, you know, like Japan and Korea, they ban it as well. So I think there's a growing awareness of the problems associated with that and more of a localism. People want to continue to control the more conventional and traditional means of getting food.
So. I'm hoping we're seeing this globalization crumble, that this is, we've got to stop this globalization effort that gives them too much consolidation over all of the supply chains. We saw how COVID challenged that, and it's not good for any of us.
No.
It's better if our food comes from more locally distributed regions and as much as we can obtain. I realize you can't get a car that's made in your state necessarily, but let's make these things in America. If you're in Canada, let's mm-hmm. make these in Canada, that kind of a model.
Absolutely. I'm a big supporter of localism. I mean, it's whenever possible, and we could even get into that. It's a bigger subject that we could even discuss at this point, but yes, I mean, that's a very positive trend. I mean, homeschooling, even local currencies are something that's being experimented with. So anyhow, listen, I really appreciate you joining me, Blair. Blair Allen Gatsby is my guest. Religious Delusions, American Style, Manipulations of the Public Mind. The book is available at Trine Day Books and also at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Blair, let's stay in touch. You know, keep up. This is great. You know, I want to do more programming. I'm on Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. So I'm looking for interviews and guests. So please stay in touch with me if you have something you're working on, and we'll do it. So
I will. Thank you, Charles. It's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Same here. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Great afternoon.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.